All right. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Commander and Coffee Podcast, where there's always something brewing. I'm Chris, also known as Cypher.
I'm Billy, also known as Cork.
I'm Y, better known as the 25th letter of the alphabet.
Well, welcome back to another episode. Like I said, today's brew is a hot one with a little metallic aftertaste. Today's episode, we're talking all about Myria, Scholar of Antiquities. But before we get into that and we get into the meat and potatoes of the episode today, how are you guys doing? What's going on in your worlds today, this week?
I mean, I guess in the meat category, I made an awesome Korean barbecue the other day. I still cooked a ribeye and just DIY'd it, and it was really good. And not much in the magic category. I'm looking at building popper decks still. And I don't want to give spoilers because I think I want to make an episode out of it. But I am testing a personal brew of mine that I have not seen on any database or anywhere at all. I think I maybe have something worthwhile here. So I'm going to be building it today and I'm going to be testing it soon. And with a little bit of luck, I think that it might be its own episode very soon. So keep your eyes open.
Nice. What about you, Billy Cork?
Oh, not too much. On the tail end of all my softball things. So I get to relax soon and go back to, you know, life as we know it. Joined a bowling league, a wiffle ball league. I just kind of keep doing what I do. Wiffle ball is surprisingly difficult from what I remember being a kid and playing it. Maybe it's just because I'm old.
I mean, maybe. I don't... Possibly.
you never know. Things happen when I get old.
Old man syndrome. for me, it's not too much. I have, again, continued to delve into my real world stuff. It's been busy and hectic in my life, but overall, it's been fun. To some extent, just working through life and trying to get through it. Magic's been pretty fun. I've been in the popper space. As of the recording of this, we just got the initiative bannings that rolled through popper. I was sort of a fan of that happening. I was looking at getting into the deck list because it was turning more into a combo deck, but I think the ban's probably for the best overall for the format. So good to see that gone. So I can just keep on cycle storming, which is probably my, like, it honestly in Magic's history, probably like my like third favorite deck I've ever played. So like it's really high up there in decks that I really like to play. So I've been playing a little bit of that and then just kind of working on storm decks and different other types of decks for CDH and EDH and stuff like that. I've really gotten my casual space brewing lately. So I've been trying to figure out what casual deck I want to build. And if I just want to play a little more relaxed EDH, it's been a couple of years since I last, was involved in that type of space. So, I'll be interested to see if I can get back into that again. Other than that, that's about it for me.
Yeah. I think it's good to keep a casual deck on the side as well. I mean, a lot of what I do, I only play CEDH because the people around me happen to, right? I mean, if other people were playing a lower power format, I probably would be on that too. So I'm also very opportunistic like you are with that, Cypher. Yeah, I think it's great to kind of see the format from other angles. And like sometimes you pick up on a lower power deck and you realize, oh, maybe this is actually a notch or two stronger than we expect. So I think some of these brews that we've been coming up with and some of the things that I've tried in the past started as being like a high power at best commander that, you know, maybe actually has more merit than people expect. So there's a lot that could maybe translate.
Yeah, for me, the biggest thing is as I continue to try and push the format, you know, I'm a 60 card spike, 60 card grinder, whatever you want to call it. As I try and push CDH to its like utmost echelons and see what's going on with it, I like to want to try to just kind of relax and play a little more casual game, right? Get back into like what EDH was supposed to be, like, as opposed to playing in these like high powered, crazy, like, you know, no holds barred optimal build CEDH decks that I've been brewing in for a while. So really excited to like just dust off cards that I'm like, oh yeah, this card's like Gilded Lotus and stuff like that. Like get back into 5 mana, you know, artifacts that tap for 3. It was like really just something I'm interested in doing right now. So it's been fun. Been enjoying it.
It's like when you break out the old Game Boy Color and try to play Pokemon Red version or something like that again.
Absolutely. Yeah, don't go running those again.
Get that nostalgia factor.
That's kind of what's been going on with us. Hopefully, it seems like everybody's doing really well, which is great to see. But let's get into why we're here today. We are here to talk about Myria, Scholar of Antiquities. This brew is brought to you by our resident control slash stacks expert, Billy. He is a big fan of this style of deck. So really excited to hear his takes on it. But I'll kind of lead it off and kind of tell what Myria does and then pass it off to him to kind of run us through this. So Myria, very interesting commander. Is a new one from Dominaria United, the second in our line of Dominaria United episodes. She is a red and a green commander, so Gruul commander. She's an elf artificer. She is a 3/3, and you may tap an untapped non-token artifact you control to add green to your mana pool. And then you can also tap two untapped non-token artifacts you control to exile the top card of your library, and then you may play it this turn. So she's got some resemblances to some current other colored commanders that exist. So with that, I'll kind of pass it over to Billy. Go ahead and talk us through Myria.
I left my Urza at home and all my blue cards, so I happen to have all the artifacts. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to play this then. She shares a striking resemblance to one Urza, Lord High Artificer, where it turns all your static artifacts into mana rocks. And it also plays through, you know, some of the quintessential stacks effects like Null Rods and Collector Ooze and all those type of things. One of the other things that it does get access to is to turn off those stacks pieces like Trinisphere, Winter Orb, even technically if you know you wanted to get mana advantage and run a Howling Mine. I know I saw a crazy Legacy brew running that once before with Myria and Urza. It was kind of neat, but I don't know if it's worthwhile, but that's perfectly fine because turning it off, letting yourself draw, or turning it on to let yourself draw one extra card is interesting. But the basic gist of it is stacks out, develop early stacks pieces super early, slow the table down, and then use your commander to break the parity to get everything going. One of the combos, quintessential combos in here, is the Possibility Storm lock with Voidmere. I think we all kind of know what Possibility Storm does, and you know, I don't know if you really need to go into that one, but it also, with Voidmere, which is a slightly weirder one, what that does is it kind of has the same effect as Lavinia, where when a player casts a spell, if no colored mana was spent to cast it, counter that spell. So with Possibility Storm, because you're casting it off of the flip, it counters it. So you just can't. But Possibility Storm is only from hand. So Myria gets around it by exile the top card and play it from there. The other combo that's really nice is the Conspicuous Snoop combo, where you're able to...
Snoop, there it is.
Snoop, there it is indeed. Where you're able to just crack the Snoop pile super easily with Myria. I also have in here a couple other combos that I really like. Cloudstone Curio with Dockside, generate infinite mana, and go to town from there. Then go into Finale Devastation to wipe the board. I also have the Underworld Breach line in here with Grinding Station and LED, of course. What's really neat with that one is you get to tap your LED for extra mana as you do it. And then at the end of it, just cast a big, big Walking Ballista and finish off your opponents.
So it sounds like you have a couple main lines in your deck. What is your like number one game plan? Are you being opportunistic? Because I know like green-red is a little bit lighter on the tutors in comparison to other common combinations. Are you just kind of like flipping into what you see and then adjusting your game plan accordingly? Or is there a line that you're really trying to lean into as soon as you can?
Great question. Yes, you're absolutely correct because of the lack of, you know, tutors to get the other ones. The biggest one that I'm doing is actually the creature one. So I want to get a Goblin Recruiter and go for Snoop line as soon as possible.
Yeah, Snoop's a pretty clean, compact combo in green-red, right? There's not that many different lines to go into I can think of off the top of my head in green-red, Snoop being a pretty low requirement. I think it's just four red, a colorless, and then a way to draw a card is technically the full line from on a single turn, but if you break it up over two turns, you really just need red to win the game.
Yeah, exactly. That's the beauty of it.
it's pretty cost effective. And then what's really cool, I like the fact that as of note, as we go through this, I don't remember if it was said, but I'm going to say it anyways. One of the neat things I like about Miria is she's very similar to Urza in that she herself has the effect to generate the green mana. It's not on the artifact itself. So if people are playing the Null Rot or Collector Oof effects, you just ignore that effect completely and your artifacts still tap for green mana, which is really cool. And then they can still tap to exile the cards from the library there, which is really great. So mana production and pseudo card draw all in one.
Yeah, to everyone listening, don't get caught by that in tournament. You have to learn once and then you know, but like you, when you learn that one time, you really, it's a very strong statement. Oh, the Null Rod doesn't do anything functionally here. Uh-oh.
So I like the combos. Obviously, the other combo I think we have on here you talked about was Breach Lines, and that makes sense. I think Breach is one of the most powerful cards in the format, if not like arguably the most powerful card outside of something like Fast Mana. So really great to see something like that in a deck like this. Pretty obvious, take advantage of it. You are limited in your play patterns per se, though, right? Because you're really looking at grinding station and stuff like that to go off, where you don't really have things like brain freeze to do clean kills. You're using and I don't think you're on it. You're not on. No, you are on Wheel of Fortune. Okay, so you have that line as well available to you as to kind of get through there. So neat. So that's kind of like the combos. What about removal? What type of removal are you prioritizing, and how much of it, and what are we doing with that?
Like what I alluded to before, it is hard to get around Cursed Totem effects. So, for instance, that's why I prioritize things like a Braid to get rid of Cursed Totem, or things that deal damage. Lavinia is a little rough because I don't have like 3 damage is pretty much the way to be. But also you have other things like Deflecting Swat, which could technically be a removal, you know, whatever you want it to be removed as, and Red Elemental Blast, of course. But those are kind of my main removal pieces.
Yeah, I mean, you have some good stuff. You have lightning bolts, braids, that kind of stuff. So it's minimum removal here. I don't think it doesn't look like in the deck list that's the name of the game. We're just trying to remove a bunch of stuff from the board. So you pick the good ones, the braids, the lightning bolts, the things you can play in Gruul. So not too bad there. Interested look when we move into, as we move into protection here. It looks like there's a bunch of standard good stuff here. You have Red Elemental Blast, not Pyro. I just want to know if that's a conscious decision or lack of space to put both. Deflecting Swat's obviously really good. Veil of Summer is a great card. But one of the main cards I wanted to talk through is, I see you've adapted to Defense Grid. Is this a really strong Defense Grid deck? Is it fast enough that it wants to be a Defense Grid deck? Like, I know having that effect is usually pretty potent to a combo kill turn, but how has that been in your deck list?
It's great on the combo turn because it's my version of silence. That's the biggest thing. Otherwise, it kind of sits in my hand because I don't want to give the opportunity to my opponents to be able to not interact with one of my other comboing opponents.
Yeah, that makes sense. The last card in the protection interaction line is, I see you're on Vexing Shusher. Walk me through how that got, where the decision came in to include that card into the list.
Well, we don't talk about Shusher. I want another way to protect my pieces. It makes any spell uncounterable, or well, can't be countered, not uncounterable. It itself can't be countered. And also it helps me interact on the stack if I need to force something through, whether it's mine or my opponent's. And that adds an extra level of creativity, I guess you could say, in how I can manipulate the stack, being in Gruul.
It's also a goblin and can be tutored with several of the goblin tutors we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, we were just going to bypass that part.
You forgot. It's fine.
I did forget. I'm like, it's a shaman. It's fine.
It's a goblin. It's definitely tutorable. So that's why I like it. I like it's protection. It's a tutorable Veil of Summer, right? Like, it's more expensive, obviously, in what you have to do, but you can tutor for it to kind of get it into your hand in a deck that doesn't get to play the best tutors. So you're looking for corner cases that maximize cards you already want to play is pretty cool. I like stuff like that. Just trying stuff out like that. In Gruul, obviously, with card filtering and card draw, you don't have too many options here. Obviously, we're playing Sylvan Library, a fantastic draw spell. And we are on a singleton wheel, Wheel of Fortune. Is this used primarily for draw, or are we just mainly having it for combo? Because I know we're not on Misfortune, right? The other wheel card draw spell you could potentially be playing, or things like that. Is this strictly just because you wanted a draw effect that works with Underworld Breach, or is there another reason this one got slotted in over adding extras?
It's mainly the functionality with Breach. That's the whole reason that this one is in there over Misfortune. I could definitely see slotting it in, Misfortune, I mean, but I kind of liked the other choices I had with the other tutors to try and get out the Snoop line as soon as possible, like Sylvan Tutor and stuff like that.
So this is where I half agree with you, Billy. Well, I agree with the first part of that statement that you made. I think Wheel of Fortune is really good if you are running the Breach line. In this deck, being a Staxy deck, I don't know if I like adding Wheel of Misfortune, because kind of just because I agree with you so strongly on the fact that Wheel of Fortune is in here as a combo piece and less of a draw spell. It's incidentally a draw spell in the times that you want it, but we kind of like, we've had discussions in the past about, I think we talked about it when we were discussing Winota about like, why not play Wheel? What we kind of landed on there was that you don't want to give three opponents a full hand of cards, a fresh new grip to your only seven on your side, because your opponents are, against a stacks deck, your opponents are more likely to want to take down the board state that you've built up. You definitely don't win the Maria, you're ahead on the card advantage engine based on the text. Like, that's the game plan you want, right? You want to be flipping cards throughout the game, trying to get incremental advantage every turn cycle. And I don't know if, like, Wheel of Misfortune, like, resetting the hands is necessarily what you need to be doing in every game.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I definitely think of it more as a combo card in this particular archetype. I don't think you want to be overloading on wheels, but there's definitely these artifact style decks too. The other reason I brought it up is there's definitely a notion where some of the times you just kind of like dump your whole hand onto the table, right? Like, you know, it's like turn two and you've deployed your lands, your mana rocks, and your stacks pieces, and now you're just kind of out of gas waiting to draw through, right? And you know, when you're playing a stacks deck from a non-stacks player, you're waiting for the table to find an answer to it, right? Who's gonna pop first and remove the stacks piece that is kind of disrupting them. So unfortunately, have to giving them seven cards versus being able to refill your hand and continue to deploying lock pieces and stuff like that feels kind of important for this deck.
Yeah, that's kind of where Miria comes in, because she alone helps you refill from that as well, from dumping your hand, because you just tap two to exile the card. So you even if you have two, which I don't know how, it would end up drawing you an extra card every turn.
Yeah, it seems like a deck that plays very well being Hellbent. I think this is an advantage that Maria has over Urza. You can make whatever arguments you want with like the color comparisons, right? Blue versus red, green. There's a whole episode we can just dedicate to that sentence right there. But I think playing on an empty hand, I would rather have a Maria in play than an Urza in a vacuum, just because of the ease of access to getting card advantage from that board state.
I think one of the biggest advantages to Miria too, in that regard, and I know it says non-token, so I can read, don't at me at the comments, but being able to play Dockside is really big in this type of deck. Just being able to create a whole bunch of treasures and then convert those treasures into more artifacts and just more stacks pieces and more punishment, right? Like, Urza's tries to snowball and it does what it can through snowballing, but like, you know, if your board gets wiped, you're kind of codependent on what's going on. Well, with Miria, you can just slam an early Dockside, make a bunch of treasures, and then there's your mana. You're off to the races versus something like Urza, where you really have to play a little more of a slower game.
Dockside sure is a goblin, so you have incidental synergy with that. Just by sheer luck, you get a bunch of things that get you a Dockside that can otherwise just get you your combo.
Yeah, and also at us, it's CMDR_coffee on Twitter. Thanks. It's good for the algorithm.
You at them. Don't at me. I get it. I read the card. I understand what it says, but just Dockside is powerful. speaking of ways to tutor Dockside, looking at the tutors that we have available to the deck list, I see a plethora of good suites. You know, we have basic Instant Speed Tutor and Court of Calling. We have Eldritch Evolution, which is just an all-star. Finale of Devastation, you know, Tutor and Wincon, Recursion from the Graveyard. Gamble, I think that's an... I don't think I've ever not played a red deck that doesn't play Gamble anymore. We have our two Goblin Tutors in Goblin Matron and Goblin Recruiter, which I'll have you talk about once I go through this. Imperial Recruiter, again, industry standard. Survival of the Fittest, another great card. Worldly Tutor, and then Sylvan Tutor we've gone into. So we've gone even into Sorcery Speed Worldly Tutors to maximize our tutor density here. I think that's good. I can't think of any other tutors that I think you were missing that I'd want you to run. So I think your tutors look pretty good to me.
I think that's a good point to mention. There's another pretty active deck list out there. At the time of recording, I see it was updated 2 days ago. This is from the Urza at Home list, authored by Necro, Once is Once, and the Mormonator. I see they have actually a pretty big difference, and we'll talk about that more as we go on. Currently a 28-card difference between Billy's deck and this deck. Some of the tutors they're on, Summoner's Pact in here, Crop Rotation to flip into like something like an Emergent Zone, Cavern of Souls, Gaia's Cradle. And I also see they're on a card that I have a lot of playtesting experience with, being a Salvala pilot. They are running a Shared Summons, which I think could have a lot of merit to this deck, being an instant speed tutor that gets you two creatures. So you can be looking for like your Recruiter and a Dockside to give you enough mana to get there. You can be getting a Kiki combo, maybe just like a Vexing Shusher and one other piece that you need at the time just to make sure it resolves. I think Shared Summons has a lot of upside. It is a 5-mana spell, but Maria, when you make a bunch of Mox Emeralds, I think that the opportunity to cast it is there in an average game.
It's 5 treasures, I think, for the Dockside Temur Sabertooth loop, right? It's 5. Is that the number? I'm just trying to think of it.
Magic number is 5, yes.
So like even that's a possibility too, right? You could go and grab Temur Sabertooth Dockside and then be able to like just kind of combo from there turn before. Could actually have your 5-mana ad nause. Yeah, there's always value for that too. I think that's always a good pull. That's a potentially powerful card in the deck. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know. I'll leave it to Billy to answer this. But for me, it's like interesting, right? Because I think that's pulling it like, do you want to be stacks or do you want to be proactive? But I think it's fine either way. I don't think it's a bad card to have in the deck.
So the biggest thing with that one is it's 5-mana. I'm looking to win before that. I'm looking to bum rush Goblin Recruiter as soon as I can. Summoner's Pact was high on my list. The downside of having to pay on the next upkeep is the reason that I did not want to run it, mainly because I'm not looking to have that much mana for the next turn. I'm looking to end the game. Goblin Recruiter and a way to crack the pile into the Conspicuous Snoop wins the game right then and there. And that's what I'm looking to do. I'm not looking to end the game. The Sax pieces here are just for extra layers of protection, in all honesty. But basically, get Goblin Recruiter, cast it, win the game. That's why I didn't go with the Shared Summons or the Summoner's Pact. And also why there's probably a 27-card difference, in all honesty.
Yeah, you also have the Hyrax Tower Scout as a backup line too, right?
Correct.
Two lines, both involving Kiki. We love layered combos. That's a good example.
Looking at some Recursion, we have a few more goblins to talk about. This is secretly Goblin Tribal. I know what you're trying to do. we have Goblin Engineer and Goblin Welder. I think both of those just kind of speak for themselves in an artifact-based deck, right? Yeah, you can get almost all of your artifacts, it looks like, off of Goblin Engineer, so that seems like a no-brainer. It literally can tutor like all of your important cards. And then Welder's obviously great at recurring them, as well as a standard Noxious Revival in the deck list.
Goblin Engineer allows me to tutor a piece into the graveyard. So if I wanted to put the defense grid in there and combo out on my next turn, sure, I could do that. If I wanted to weld something out, I could keep swapping things out. So I could keep recurring and using my Grim Monolith and Mana Vault without having to worry about paying the 4. I could even just tutor the Void Mirror into the graveyard and just pull that out when I want. It's also really nice to keep recurring a Tangle Wire because you sack it at your end step for something literally generic. You get to untap fully, and then you bring it back so that they have to deal with 4.
I also like that you can up your actions per minute with a Welder or an Engineer. If you have like a Sensei's Divining Top in play, you can just be drawing a card in response, swapping it from your graveyard, and doing a bunch of like really tiny bits of card interaction every turn cycle.
Microtransactions to
just incidental synergies that you get to build up.
Or you can tap a Mox Opal to engineer away when there's a Kataki in play to keep swapping your artifacts out and do absolutely nothing.
True.
Right, Billy?
Yes, because I wanted to take game actions.
I feel like Mary is like the biggest like game actions commander out there right now in terms of like similar things. I mean, you're doing so much in an average game. I know that, you know, this is your deck, Billy, but I mean, I played it briefly and I think I put more things, just more things on the stack in those two games that I played than an entire week of playing anything else. I feel like Mary's just like, the goal is to just drive full speed into a traffic jam. You're just like riding the left lane to the very last minute and making everyone else's life miserable as a result.
Yeah, I might be miserable at best with when I'm playing this deck.
All right. Speaking of being miserable and misery, this is my misery and miserable moment. So we're going to go through this really fast, even though this should probably be the longest point in the section, because I hate talking about stacks effects. We're going to talk about stacks and how the stacks effects apply to this deck. So looking at your stacks list, you play crappy Blood Moon. You play crappy Collector Oof. You play crappy Magus of the Moon. You play crappy Maglehorn. You play crappy Null Rod. I don't care about Phyrexian Revoker. I'll let that one go. That one's fine. You play crappy Possibility Storm. You play crappy Static Orb. I can go on. So there's a lot of powerful stacks effects. I think the big ones are Static Orb, Winter Orb, you know, Trinisphere. Those effects that, like, when they're tapped or untapped, it's the standard Urza stuff. You can turn turn them one sided, which is really powerful and effective in what you're doing. So I think that's really cool there. We talked about the Possibility Storm Void Mirror lock. That's really cool. I don't like Void Mirror either, to be honest with you. So that's a crappy card too. It's really fun to see like a whole bunch of stacks effects, and I can't wait till we get into the ramp to have that ramp package alongside something like a Collector Oof and a Null Rod. It's just really neat to see in the deck list. So really cool stuff here. I guess the two cards that I see a lot of Myriad decks talking about that I wanted to know if you've tested or given your input on, a lot of them are on Howling Mine, to kind of create like a one-sided pseudo, like once a turn Rhystic Study style effect where they get to draw like one bonus card and nobody else gets to draw the bonus card. And then the other one that I've seen a lot of them playing is, and I think I get to get the name correct, is Storage Matrix. I believe that's the card I'm thinking of. They have to choose like what they're untapping, and that's the only type that they're allowed to untap for the turn. I wonder if you've tested those or what your thoughts are with those two cards.
So first off, I did mention the Howling Mine earlier.
I'm bringing it up again. What are you going to do about it?
I know. I'm going to finish my sentence.
Good. I hope you can. I'm going to interrupt.
That's fine. You can interrupt me. This is a song that gets on everybody's nerves. I don't think that the Howling Mine thing was worth it in personal testing, because it is just one spell per turn. Yes, or one card per turn. That's nice, but my commander does that by itself.
Yeah, just play like Ichor Wellspring or Baubles or something like that, because the moment Mary leaves the battlefield, now you're just pushing the gameplay into a direction that I don't think you're favored anymore. You're taking a lot of risk for a very, very small reward of one card a turn cycle, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't like giving three other players the cards, right? You get your opponents plus three cards for your one card with a Howling Mine. That's why it's typically pretty bad. That was the one I was kind of the most like, yeah, I understand that one. Storage Matrix is interesting, though. Like, you're playing Tangle Wire, but like, I was interested why you picked that over something like Storage Matrix, because it feels like it could be doing similar things, if not being better overall when Miri is in play.
Biggest thing was speed, in all honesty. I wanted to be able to generate as much mana and as much value as I possibly can. Storage Matrix tends to slow me down as well. That's really what it boils down to. In all honesty, I love the card. I played it in a lot of other decks, you know, stacks and stuff like that. But that was it. I just wanted to be able to untap all my things. Like, yeah, it's nice for them, but I can't break parity as well under that one.
Agreed. I hate Blood Moon and I hate Magus of the Moon, but I think they're really good in here. Obviously, being able to shut off other people's lands, and you want your lands to make red because your green comes from your artifact, so those seem really sweet in this deck list. I like the addition of TorModScript 2. At first, I'll be honest with you, when you listen, I was like, why? And you're like, because it's a zero mana rock. And I was like, oh yeah, that's just a Mox, isn't it? That's a Mox Emerald. Holy crap.
The Urza at Home list is on a copy of Heapdall, which is a similar category, with the, I guess, added benefit. I mean, pros and cons, it costs one and not zero. But the benefit is that with Heapdall, you can tap it for mana. And to exile a card from the graveyard, it just sacrifices itself. It doesn't tap. So you can be floating a green and using its ability in the same turn cycle if you need. Personally, I like the Tormod script, but I mean, there's certainly a world where you can play both.
Yeah, it's just an interesting corner case as our listeners. You want to go out and brew these versions yourself, you know, look for effects like that, right? Like, it's a removal spell when you want it to be a removal spell, but it's also a mana when you need it to be a mana.
Yeah, it's not just mana. It is also a card draw, per se, because you get to exile, tap two and exile it with Miria. With Miria, not Emiria.
Different card.
Yeah.
Yes. So, really cool effects on stacks. I don't have anything else on that. You have any other follow-ups, questions, comments, concerns, anything you want to bring up on stacks? I kind of blew through that really quick, but not intentionally when I said I hated it to begin with, but I ended up doing it anyways because I just really don't like it.
Yeah, I don't think it's in your list right now, Billy, but you were for a time, and I think maybe you still are. You want to put it in. Are you on the Karn package at the moment? I think it's out of the deck at the moment.
It is currently out right now.
Yeah, do you, I don't know if you have like any big things to say about it. I mean, it's a solid package, seems to match the theme of the deck, maybe a bit expensive.
The expense is really what it is, and I this new package is just more compact and does a lot more for me and lets me just win the game pretty much on the spot.
I think now's a good time to talk about it too. Like, I don't think any of these cards that we've been talking about when Billy's saying like, oh yeah, they're a little slow. Billy plays a lot of games with me and our group, and we like turbo decks and we like to go fast. So he's really playing to be a little more proactive and on the gun because we're trying to win super early and aggressively. So if you find your format's a little more mid-rangey or more on the slower end of the spectrum, I think those cards are perfectly reasonable into this style of deck. I just think like for Billy, he's trying to maximize this deck kind of, one, more ambiguous against these turbo decks, but two, to kind of be the better version against a blind meta, right? If you're playing against a bunch of turbo, a bunch of stacks decks, this deck can kind of play to its strengths, I think, a little differently than those decks can.
Well, it's not just that. If you're running the Karn package, now the Karn package, just so you know, so full disclosure, was running Karn the Great Creator and Microsynth Lattice. You would then have to take out the Null Rod and the Collector Oof as well, which I think that in the current state of the game, at the time of this recording, Collector Oof and Null Rod are more powerful than Karn Lattice Lock, being both of those are 2 mana and function earlier than 10 mana and lock the game out later. Yes, can I Goblin Weld out a Microsynth Lattice and cast a Karn the Great Creator? Absolutely. But that's Magical Christmas Land, and CDH does not function in Magical Christmas Land.
I don't think that's too controversial of a statement. 2 is less than 4. 2 is, you could argue, even more less than 6 than it is 4, being the way the numbers are. Oof is going to be a counter meta defining card until the end of days, I think. That's just always going to be in your creature-y green deck, and I think it is wrong to leave home without it. Even playing an artifact-centric deck like Maria, I think there's just like such a good reason to be on it.
There's been a discussion point that we've been had lately where I was even like, Oof actually kind of feels a little slow in and of itself at 2 mana, right? Like, it's still powerful into what it does, but like, there's definitely a world where like these faster, you know, Grixis Ad Nauseam turbo decks just kind of like, all right, well, there's an Oof, I'll deal with it and move on with my life and kind of keep on keeping on. So there's even worlds where even that's like, is it really that good?
You find a nice opener with like a turn one Sol Ring and can't cast your Oof, and you will never want to drop $100 bill faster than knowing that you could have had a Null Rod instead that turn.
Yeah, I mean, because like, especially with Oof, right? Like, then you have an Oof. It's like, all right, well, I'm just going to cast my zero mana Roger and put a Deadly Relic on it, and now all my stuff is free and I'm back to doing what I want to do. So, hard to say. But anyways, it's an interesting take to do it. But yeah, this deck is definitely designed to be a little more faster, a little more proactive, while still trying to be a stacks deck, trying to play into the tournament scene, the 75-minute rounds, and to play against those faster decks was kind of where that was headed. So moving into the fast stuff, my favorite stuff.
Yeah, take it away, Cypher.
Yeah, right. I'm good at this today. I'm on fire. A good amount of ramp in here. A lot of neat stuff that you see typically in these artifact-centric like Urza decks. I see you're borrowing the Everflowing Chalice. You're borrowing the Jeweled Amulet. You have Paradise Mantle in here, which is great because it literally turns your commander into a mana dork, as well as itself being able to tap to generate a mana in and of itself, which is really cool to see. Unlike Urza, you do get to play like Birds of Paradise, I see, which is in here. One of my favorite things about Myria is that you can tap a Lion's Eye Diamond for green and then sack it for 3 mana, so you get 4 mana out of your LED.
That's what I wanted to bring up, because the ramp, in my opinion, for this deck is kind of on the specific side. There's a really like general end of that conversation and a really specific end, because on the general side, you can say like every artifact in your deck is a ramp piece, and we're not going to name all of them because you have...
29. The answer is 29.
29 of them. Which also, you have 2 artifact lands as well, so you have all those are technically ramp pieces, if you put it that way. A lot of them are very bad 3-mana ramp pieces, but they still add up over the course of an average game. Here's the bottleneck with Myria that I think we should discuss a little bit in detail. Myria is really good at making Mox Emeralds. Your Snoop combo needs Mox Ruby, so you can make a lot of green. Converting that to red is necessary sometimes, and your rocks and your ramp pieces that make red are going to be your valuable pieces when you're actually trying to get to the win in a lot of cases. What are the pieces that are like specifically converting to red for you right now, Billy?
Birds of Paradise, Arcane Signet, Chrome Mox, Jeweled Amulet, Mox Amber, Mox Diamond, Mox Opal, Paradise Mantle are all kinds of ones right off the top. I am heavier in the red splashes for my lands as well. That's pretty much the long and short of it. Dockside, too, if you count it. LED, if I need it to. Because I could crack an LED for red while Goblin Recruiter's on the stack.
Yeah, I just thought that was worth mentioning, just because like you're exceptionally good at making green. At the end of the day, you are a 2-color deck. So getting that first green pip to cast your commander is crucial. So you do have to have some investment into green, which, you know, with fetch lands, it's really not that big of an ask. And then it's just the question of like being able to make 1 or 2 green to get off the ground. And then from there, you really want to be trying to convert to red whenever you can. That's kind of the view I have on it a lot of the time. And I see the Urza at Home deck. They're actually really, I think, thinking about that. They're on a copy of Manamorphose, which is really funky. Until you consider like it can turn green into red, which sometimes you really do need to hit that many red pips in a turn cycle. I think that's a really cool inclusion to think about. It almost reminds me, again, going to Green-White Salvala, Wooded Bastion, the filter land from the Shadowmoor block. It's a land that can take your main color and convert it into dual pips of your off color.
I don't know, I heard Manamorphose and I got excited, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, sorry, still not Storm. It's a utility Manamorphose, I should say, but that's like the weirdest.
I was totally in Modern right now. I'm like, oh man, I missed that deck. That's definitely an interesting conundrum. I think things like Jessica's Will and stuff really help that line to get there as well, too, from it. And obviously, I actually think, like, in some regards, the Back to Basics and the Magus of the Moon, the Blood Moon, excuse me, that's the one. I'm in green-red.
Yeah, you wish we were playing blue.
The Blood Moon and the Magus of the Moon really help facilitate generating extra red pips, right? Because then it guarantees you more and more red mana, right? Like, turning your colorless sources into red and turning a couple of your non-foresty green permanents later on into red sources could be pretty good.
Yeah, ironically, the Blood Moon is color fixing in this deck, which is... That's a cute little interaction for this deck.
I'm taking my segues and I'm rolling with them. Speaking of color fixing, if we take a look at the rest of your color fixing lands and your lands breakdown, you definitely are skewed, it looks like, more into the red. I think you're at 36% red versus, you know, 22% green with about... Actually, your highest percentage is actually colorless. More than half of your... Almost half of your deck is colorless pips, which is really funny.
two basic forests, though, because you do need to play under a Blood Moon to some extent.
Correct. From your production, about 41% of your cards that produce mana produce red, and then about 52% produce green, which is actually really interesting from the symbols on your lands. Pretty interesting to see what that looks like from there. So really looking at your lands, it's interesting to see the notes that you came to. I think some of the interesting ones that are worth mentioning is you're playing both Great Furnace and Tree of Tales. Notably, Great Furnace is effectively a dual land in this deck, which is really neat to see, as it can tap for a red or can be tapped for a green off of Myria, which is really cool. Being artifacts kind of gauge the benefit to be able to tap to draw a card. The biggest interesting thing I have is that you're on these lands, but you are on Nullrod and Collector Hoof, which I guess does technically turn them off, but kind of sort of doesn't. But it's really weird when you look at this deck. And at first I was like, what the hell are these doing in here? And then it just clicked in my head and it made sense. So that's cool to see. I think this is a great Urza Saga deck. I think that's another interesting land that's in here.
Yeah, how many choices do you have with your tutor on that? Probably at least like a good 15.
More than I can count.
Yeah.
I only can count to 10. That's what I have to count to. Storm 10. So I don't count past that.
The construct tokens, you know, they can get there in an average game. I mean, those are going to be like the biggest things on the board. You're going to have like a pair of, I don't know, what, 8/8s, I think is a conservative guess.
Probably a lot, yeah. War Room's a neat one. I do like War Room as a way to draw cards. I think it's a little worse in this one because you're paying 3 mana and 2 life to draw a card versus 3 mana and a life in little single color decks. But I don't think you have a lot of card draw in here. So I think having that effect in your lands to draw cards is also pretty potent.
Yeah, Inventor's Fair is another good one in here. That helps me counteract that, along with being a tutor for an artifact.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I want you to talk more about it. I'll just set the groundwork. It's really interesting when you first look at your mana base, and I was like really concerned because you're talking like Ancient Tomb, Gemstone Caverns, Inventor's Fair, Urza's Saga, War Room. You have all these colorless lands that Gaia's Cradle, which doesn't really make mana, but you have all these colorless lands like on turn one when like you really want to be making mana, but you really don't. You really want colorless pretty early on. Like you can kind of get there down the line. You really just need like a red and green to get Miri online, and then you kind of have some color fixing going on from there too. So have you noticed any issues with that though? How's your mana been flowing having such a heavy volume of colorless sources early on in the game?
Really well, actually, because a lot of them convert themselves into a color source. If I just have that, like an Ancient Tomb into an Arcane Signet is pretty legit. Or, you know, going from there, just ramping out a bunch of colorless sources and just going, okay, cool, next turn, then get going to everything else.
Yeah, the Ancient Tomb isn't necessarily casting your commander, but it is ramping out a lot of the cards in your 99, which I think is worth the slot.
Yeah, if I happen to be on less artifacts, I would definitely cut the Ancient Tomb. If almost a third of my deck was not artifacts.
So the only other land that I want to question on, and I'm just genuinely curious as to why, is I noticed, I think Y brought it up, you are on two basic forests to help continue to keep green if you need to get green online under your own Blood Moon or Magus of the Moon. But you are also on one basic mountain. Any reasoning as to just you wanted basic hate, or you wanted an extra basic land, or how come we're playing a basic mountain in the deck?
Well, I gotta protect against the Blood Moon in my deck, you know, just in case it comes down. No, I'm kidding. That's dumb. It's mainly in there because of just being able to fetch one out if I need one. I really only have two fetchable sources in Stomping Ground and Taiga. Being able to fetch for just that mountain in a pinch if for some reason I don't have a mountain somewhere. And again, like we stated earlier, red is one of my choke colors, so to speak.
I could see like this would be cut if you're in three colors, but you just like, well, you have the duel and the fetch. There's no other mountains really left to fetch. Like you need to have something because like, as we talked about the combo, like that's still short a red pip for your Snoop line, right? If you fetch all three of the mountains in your deck, you still need another red source beyond that. So like there's even an argument in my opinion for running a second basic mountain.
Yeah, I guess my argument there too was at 36% of your deck being red pips and 22% being green. I don't know if the math throws it off with the Magus or the Blood Moon, but I would be curious if it would be better, if it was better suited to swap the numbers and actually have two mountains to a singleton forest potentially in the deck list. Again, because you're producing more green from Myria online versus red, so having more lands that make red could be decent, but I don't know. I haven't done the math on it. I was just genuinely curious on that.
It's one of those things that I need the green earlier, so unless I am going for the package right off the bat, which again we need four mana regardless, so if I ramp out, you know, and plus a lot of my other stuff gets my artifacts get me there. So because the thing is, like, I mean, I can just recruiter and soup combo without Myria out.
We'll get into mulligans in a minute, but I think it's a really cool deck. I really liked the Billy's take on it being a proactive stacks deck, I guess is the oxymoron way to say what the deck is trying to do. I think it's a really powerful way to set up Snoop, and really powerful way to kind of set these combos up that are powerful in Gruul, but I don't think powerful overall in the context of CDH, but still having the capabilities to slow the table down to set these combos up as they do take an extra turn to set up. And like possibilities to avoid Mirror is just like, it's the worst thing in the world you can play against. It's just awful. You just, the game is completely locked out. It's terrible. I don't recommend it. It's just awful. So
not anymore though. Boseiju is a card.
Yeah, that's like you're out. I don't play green though as much as I should. So need to get the Odawara. But yeah, overall I think it's a really cool deck. So with that, before we get into mulligans, I think it's time for a coffee break. So who's prepped today's coffee?
I did. I have brewed the coffee. Here's the thing. I just got my student loan refund back, so I haven't been able to spend money for the last month. And as a result, I don't really have a lot of new coffee. I mean, I can talk about the really cool stuff again. I'm more than happy to talk about anything that I've discussed a second time, because I'm probably out of some of it by now. It's so good. That being said, y'all have heard about it already, and I'm not going to recycle content. So instead, I have a coffee-related question to ask of you, because I don't know. I don't want to pretend like I'm some kind of like barista superstar coffee royalty, and I think it's kind of cool to hear. I want to know what your hypocrite drink is, your guilty pleasure, if you will. Mine is the Dunkin' Donuts matcha latte. It tastes nothing like actual fresh matcha. I've tried. I've had it elsewhere. I don't know what their blend is. The secret ingredient is probably sugar or corn syrup. But man, like every time I'm at Dunkin', I always get almond milk latte, maybe with like a half pump of caramel. And that is the sweetest drink I even have in this day and age. There's nothing else I drink like it. And I don't see myself stopping it anytime soon. And it's like four something a cup, and I do not care. I will not be stopped.
Cannot, will not, won't be stopped.
Pumpkin spice, end of discussion.
Tis the season.
But yeah, so the coffee that I had today was an Italian roast coffee. It was a dark roast, the Starbucks blend, just standard every day, about 3 cups out of 5. I definitely had 2 today, so.
Waiting on your third. Not, you didn't get a pumpkin spice, Froofy?
No, I did not get a pumpkin spice today. I haven't left the house.
What are you doing?
I didn't. You're leave a the
resident
house yet.
Pumpkin spice guy. Yeah, why are you not donuts, like, overloaded?
2 blocks away from my house.
I assumed you had pumpkin spice like on crack, and you were just ready to go. Like once like September hit, you just pulled out the pumpkin spice rub and just started like adding it to everything.
Yeah. Do you not have pumpkin spice seasoning?
I snorted a line of that this morning, and then I ended up mainlining a little bit during my morning routine. And you know, hey, we're here now, and right now it's spooky season, bitches.
I am very disappointed that you did not bring up a pumpkin spice flavored coffee today. I want you to know, I am challenging you in front of all of our listeners that you have a different pumpkin spice flavored beverage every episode through Halloween from now on. The gauntlet has been dropped.
Okay, and I will pick up that gauntlet.
Pumpkin spice lattes, macchiatos, cappuccinos.
Oh, okay. So that one can't happen. I will have a different pumpkin spice coffee, but a lot of those have a lot of sugar, and I'm not a big fan of the sugar aspect. Usually, I do have my pumpkin spice cold brew black and everything like that. So that's the biggest thing for me. So, but I will definitely get different pumpkin spice coffees. I can do that.
I think Death Wish has a pumpkin spice blend.
They do, and it's amazing. I had it last year.
I want the full tout of Billy's Best pumpkin spice coffee brands for the month of October. That's what I want to have happen. Listeners, I'm making it happen for you. If you don't like it, too damn bad. This is happening.
Spoiler, we're recording this currently in September. I have a little over 2 weeks to get this and make sure we have it.
Challenge has been dropped.
It's accepted. You're on.
So that's coffee of the week. So I think why you're going to be handed over Mulligan's here in a second. But Billy, if you want to run down kind of what we're looking for in our opening hands as we get into them and that kind of information, anything you want to open up with for Mulligan's?
So biggest thing right off the bat is we do have to look at the pod composition. I know we say this over and over and over and over again, and we're going to beat it like a dead horse or like pumpkin spice season. We're going to have it all the time. Earlier and earlier now.
I'm glad I get to subject them to this pumpkin spice nonsense I have to live through every freaking October.
Oh yeah, it was started in August this year, so I was super happy.
I can tell you guys a side tangent as I go off the road. Every time he goes to Dunkin' and they return to the pumpkin spice season, I just get a gif of just like the whitest white girl with her plaid shirt and her sweater vest drinking her pumpkin spice latte and him just giggling like a schoolgirl. So y'all get to look forward to this for the next couple of weeks. Enjoy.
Let me tell you, like I have an in-person class on my campus and the Starbucks, I mean, $3,000 of Uggs in a single room.
Listen, I get my Ugg boots, I get my leggings, and a nice sweater. I'm golden.
Billy is aptly named because he is basic with a capital B.
Capital B. Like, it's not just because my name is Billy. I'm a capital B basic Billy.
Capital B basic.
So, anyway. And basically what we're looking for in our opening hands. What we're looking for open hands is really based on the pod. If we know people are going to be faster than us, we're looking for some type of early interaction in the form of a stacks piece, whether it be like a null rod or a trinisphere that I could punch out early and really mess with people. Otherwise, it's how fast can I get to Goblin Recruiter?
I present to you the first Maria hand. I will start with lands, and then I will do my best to kind of speak on the hand in kind of its most natural way. So, our opening hand is a basic forest, Inventor's Fair, Sol Ring, Mox Opal, Defense Grid, Dockside Extortionist, and a Possibility Storm. I see a hand that looks like it works here because the forest and Inventor's Fair is kind of awkward, but you do have a red source via the Mox Opal, and on turn one you can go Fair, Sol Ring, Defense Grid, and that turns on a Mox Opal for your Maria turn two. It is a bit awkward putting a defense grid on the table without a win in hand. So a little bit risky. I think you need another artifact in your hand to really be happy with this. Do you just like lay it all on the table and put a defense grid in turn one? That seems a bit scary.
I think that's terrifying to just slam a defense grid down. I think that opens up way too many avenues for the rest of the pod to do whatever they want to do. It is interesting to say that the other team basically have to have a turn one win with it, but it's close. I really wish the defense grid was like anything else in this hand. Like defense grid and possibility storm feel like the two weakest cards in the hand, but like I really wish the defense grid was anything else.
Or if the land was a red source, because then you could just dockside, make any number of treasures, that turns on Mox Opal, and then you're fine.
Yeah, this is what we like to call a loose hand. It is definitely a trap, and I would never keep it in 1,000 years.
But it's got Sol Ring and Dockside. But you're right, I would probably mulligan this hand. It's close, but it's not good enough.
I think I gamble. You have like a 1 in 3-ish, maybe a little bit less than a 1 in 3 chance of just hitting an artifact, which is more than likely castable, which turns on your Mox Opal. That's all. That's all I have to say. I mean, the odds are not in that favor, but I probably would anyway and make a mistake.
Yeah, and then you lose the game on turn two, and then we just sit there and go, yep, shouldn't have played the defense grid.
So what happens if you hit draw? Does it just, like, add an eighth card to your hand? Ooh, I'm going to do it.
No, so you would have drawn crypt. Perfect. We did that.
That's cool. We decided to mulligan.
Y'all did. I was winning.
I think on six I would consider it. I think on six is where I would be. If I was looking at this hand specifically, like maybe 6 or 5 would be where I would probably be like, okay, this is probably good enough, right? Like, if it's on 6, you put like Defense Grid back or Possibility Storm because you're not casting those anytime soon. And then like you have a pretty decent 6 where you just want to draw into something. And then 5 is great because you're putting both back. And then like that's like Opal, Forest, Inventor's Fair, Soul Ring, Dockside is a really solid 5 in my opinion. So I just don't think it's a first 7.
You're right. This would be a consideration if I was on 6. Maybe even 5.
All right. The ballots are in. Let's mold to our second 7 then. Our second 7. Yeah, this is a lot of cool stuff. We have an Arid Mesa and a Mountain, so we are color fixed in this hand. We have a Chrome Mox and an Urza's Bauble, a Jeweled Lotus, a Walking Ballista, and a Sylvan Tutor. So, I mean, Sylvan Tutor gets you your Recruiter. We have a Turn 1 Commander with the Jeweled Lotus. And we have a really weird Chrome Mox, which is probably not imprinting anything and is just going to be a Mox Emerald. That's pretty cool.
It's a snap keep because it's a turn 2 win.
Mountain or Arid Mesa into Jeweled Lotus, crack the Lotus, tap the Mountain, play Myria, cast Bauble, Chrome Mox, tap the Chrome Mox, cast Sylvan Tutor, right? Like,
is this a turn 2? Because you need to have red sources.
Well, you have 2 red sources in your hand, right? You have the Mountain and then the Arid Mesa.
Right, but like, can you do the whole line off that? Because I thought I needed 4 red.
He needs 3 red. It's 4 red if you're going off of one, because you go Recruiter into Snoop.
Oh, yeah, in the same
and
turn.
And then Snoop into Torch Carrier. So you need 1 red, 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 red.
So 3 red. So potentially a turn 2 win, but I'd still snap keep this in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just want to accurately depict what's going on here.
Turn 4? Is that where your math's coming up as?
It's four red.
Gotcha.
4 red and a colorless is what you really need to go off from nowhere. If you tutored Recruiter to the top, it's really a turn 3 win because you go turn 1 Sylvan Tutor for Recruiter, turn 2 cast the Recruiter, set your pile up, draw your Snoop, and then you win from there. And then you only need 3 red, so then you just need to have. Well, I guess you can't even really draw the Mountain though, which is really awkward, right? Oh, I guess you could draw with the Bauble though, right? You can use your Bauble to draw the Recruiter into your hand, so you do get a blind draw.
Yeah, and you get your turn 1 draw step, so you get to see, you know, what, like 2 other random cards? Mm-hmm. So yeah, very, very solid hand. Let's do second hand, right?
Yep, second one.
Any chance you just drop a Ballista on 1
there? So I was thinking that you can drop a Ballista on 1, but I'd rather play turn 1 Myria, and then I can...
You play Myria, you drop Ballista on 1, and then you're untapping with a Ballista with a counter on it and at least 4 mana you can use to make the Ballista bigger.
I was going to say, if anything happens to your combo, that Ballista still controls the board for the entirety of the game at that point. Like, no one is playing anything significant to the board the rest of the game as a plan B.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pod dependent, but like, you could literally like turn one Myria, turn 1 Walking Ballista, X equals 1, untap, play your land. And play your land, cast a Sylvan Tutor, and still have 4 mana open to put a counter on the Ballista.
Yeah.
You could pretty much dump your whole hand, minus the basic Mountain, on turn 1. That seemed pretty cool.
Very. All right. Next game, whatever you want to call it, game 2 with Myria, our opening hand, okay, is a Tree of Tales, Inventor's Fair, everyone's favorite turn 1 keep, the Gemstone Caverns. And with that, we have an Ornithopter, a Walking Ballista, a Void Mirror, and a Sylvan Library. You get to refill your hand really easily with that Sylvan Library, which you can drop on turn 1, assuming that we aren't going first in turn order. And then follow up with like a really big turn 2, just to play whatever we see at that point. I think you're in a position to kind of just have everything you physically see with your eyes. You have everything online on turn 3. So that seems like I was saying, like you're driving head speed to creating the fastest traffic jam possible, or if you're lucky enough, just the game win at that point. You're going to be deploying a lot of permanents very, very fast with this hand.
Yeah, I think if I'm on the play, I pitch this. If I'm not on the play, then I keep this.
Odds are it's a good hand.
Having like turn 2 libraries, you not bad in a deck like this, you know, turn 1 Tree of Tales, Ornithopter, go. I just, not having a red source here kind of feels bad to me, right? Like your caverns is pretty bad. Adventure's Fair will get you.
You're
some amount
your
of
caverns
life,
is the red source really right now if you're not on the play.
Yeah, but I'm saying like if you're going if you're
oh no I said play, if I'm right, on the play like, I'm not keeping this.
I was making a case for you to keep it on the play if there was one, and I don't think there is kind of where I ended at. Just not having a red source there is kind of sketchy. I think I could do better.
And this is by no means like a metric of keep versus not keep. Overall consensus is going first we ship, anything else we keep. I just want to see, like, looking at this deck as an average, I just wanted to rip some cards off the top just to see what that Sylvan Library is doing for us in an average game. Do you mind if we do that?
Do it up.
Would you like to? Okay. So, like, okay, turn one draw step is a Court of Calling, and then our following turn, if we're doing turn one Sylvan, we're drawing the next three cards. So we are seeing a fetch land, a Phyrexian Revoker, and a Tanglewire. So you just get to vomit pretty much all this stuff into play. Court of Calling is infinitely castable. Turn two, you can be looking at a lot of good options and just, yeah, you get to answer whatever you think the best fit for the board state is on turn two, whether that be your commander or a Tanglewire or a Revoker. Court of Calling in the bank really early on. So that's just a quick example of like what you can rip with that kind of opener hand. Love turn one Sylvan Library. Let's see another game three Maria. Off to a great start. Our opener this time around is a Windswept Heath and a Boseiju for our lands. And with that, we have a Lotus Petal. Walking Ballista, again, it keeps coming back. Walking Ballista is going to be in every hand. We have an Abrade, a Deflecting Swat, and a Blood Moon with those cards. So you can do like a quick Blood Moon. You can also do a quick Commander and then follow up with a Blood Moon with a Deflecting Swat to defend it. I personally am a fan of that line because just getting Mary online before the Blood Moon ensures that you have access to green mana the whole time. Might work out pretty well.
This is a pitch. It really doesn't do enough, and it's more of a trap than anything else. Even with the Blood Moon, it just does not feel good.
What would convince you? Would it be like if there's like an Agila pod, a lot of four color partners, would that convince you for the Blood Moon, or are you just looking for better stuff on average?
From an opening seven, better stuff.
So then I would ask you, do you feel like the Blood Moon is cuttable in this deck? If an advantageous Blood Moon pod is not a keepable hand with this card in it, then is the Blood Moon good enough?
This is a turn two Blood Moon, and then it turns me off as well because it locks me out of my green mana, so I'm not quite sure how this is advantageous.
I'm saying like if you're playing in a pod with four color decks, like where Blood Moon is the strongest.
I could care less about that because it does nothing for me in this pod. I can't break parity on the Blood Moon.
The problem with the hand is like, again, you do draw a couple cards, but like you can't rely on that. So like if you go like Windswept Heath for Taiga, Boseiju Petal, crack the petal, tap out, cast Blood Moon, you now have no green sources, right? So then you're not really casting a turn two Blood Moon, you're casting a turn three Blood Moon. Because you really want to turn two your commander, and then you're casting a turn three Blood Moon, and then you're left with Walking Ballista, Abrade, and Deflecting Swat.
You are able to Windswept for basic forest and get Blood Moon with the Lotus Petal.
Sure, you can do it that way too. Sure. So then you do have a green red source there, which is fine too. But the main problem that I was more or less getting into is like you don't have the density to draw cards after that. You're kind of just stalled out. Like you have the Blood Moon effect in play, but that's your hope and prayer at this point, because you have to rely on like what you're drawing to get you, because you don't have access. You don't have Ballista plus an artifact to start either generating counters on the Ballista or using them to exile and draw an extra card each turn. So like there's a chance that like somebody could set up like a Rhystic Study or get like a Mystic Remora down, or you know, can find an answer to the Blood Moon and just bury you in card advantage, and then like kill the Blood Moon when it's advantageous for them to kill the Blood Moon, which is the biggest problem that I have with this hand per se, is that it leaves you, you're really relying on the top of your deck being good and the Blood Moon doing a lot, which the Blood Moon probably will do a lot, but you're really relying on the top of your deck to kind of figure out where you're going from there.
Yeah, if there was like a Jeweled Lotus or a Mana Crypt in the hand, I'd be more hard up to kind of you know, think about this a lot more, because then I could get the either Miri out on turn one or get Walking Ballista out on turn one as well. So that way I have another way and another source of mana.
And I should clarify, I don't disagree with this. I just wanted to kind of like open up that discussion, because I think these trap hands are pretty common in a lot of stacks decks. How much are you leaning on the strongest stacks piece in your hand? Because if you don't have the cards to support it, or if you don't have the means to deploy other pieces first, then you're creating a stacks board state where everyone is at parity. And if you're not breaking parity, then you're not playing to the strengths of your deck. I think that's just a good frame of mind to put yourself in whenever you're playing anything stacksy, anything with, like, whether it be Blood Moon or Winter Orb or Root Maze or Rule of Law. Not just having the stacks pieces, but also having a way to get ahead on them is how you're going to win a game.
Yeah, and especially in like the cases with like against like things like Najeela too, like she's base red, and like you have the ability to deal with her one time, but like she's still base red, so like your Blood Moon's not turning her off her ability to cast and start doing combat damage with her. So again, you're really relying on kind of what's going on the top of your deck. So that's why I think it's close to a bad hand. Especially for a first seven, like it gets a lot better at like, again, like the five card slot is where I'm like, you know, Living on a Prayer, man, slamming Blood Moon team, where we go.
Good insight, folks.
Yeah, that's also a very loose thing to do.
Look, man, I'm on five. I'm playing loose then with the Gruul deck on five.
Let's see our second seven.
I don't know about you. Maybe I'm wrong, but
second seven, we have a lot of lands. We have a Karplusan Forest, Command Tower, Arid Mesa, Basic Forest, a Braid, Birds of Paradise, and a Goblin Sharpshooter. This is one of the issues of the Snoop Lines. I mean, this is like the, I guess you can say, the trade-off for running a Snoop Line, which in this deck is a very strong avenue to winning the game. We do have hands like this that come up, where we have a Goblin Sharpshooter in the opener. It's kind of an awkward card in the opener, not exactly what we're looking for outside of the combo turn. Kind of makes this a functional six-card hand. I would expect that we're going down to six here.
I was going to say, this looks like a six card hand to me, so I really want to go down to it.
Yeah, it's definitely a six card hand. I mean, Goblin Sharpshooter is also serves our purpose of killing off the dorks if there's dorks at the table. But meh, it's perfectly fine without it. It's basically a six carder.
Let's take a look at our actual six card consideration. We have the basic forest just keeps coming back. And there's the Walking Ballista with it. They're perpetually in the opener. So we have Basic Forest, Verdant Catacombs, Mox Opal, Walking Ballista, Goblin Welder, Magus of the Moon, and a Manglehorn.
This one was almost there. It's a risky keep because of the Welder and stuff like that. If that was a Goblin Engineer, I'd probably definitely keep it. Actually, no, I know I would definitely keep it. Not probably. But being that it's a Welder and I don't have some way of putting a artifact in my grave to swap it aside from just looping my Walking Ballista. And not only that, my Ox Opal is not turned on. So this is a ship. Go down to five.
Okay, let's see our five card option. It is a Tree of Tales, Arid Mesa, Winter Orb, Lightning Bolt, Goblin Recruiter, Birds of Paradise, and Hyrax Tower Scout. I mean, there's the combo enabler right on the hand. And with the turn one birds, you can be deploying turn two commander and setting up a lot of good things with that. And you even have the Winter Orb synergy. With this hand, it looks like you can either go for the fast combo with Goblin Recruiter, or you can just be hanging back and putting out a Winter Orb, which you break parity on.
So I 100% keep this hand. Off the sole fact that, yes, I am on five, and yes, Goblin Recruiter may be in my hand, but I actually want to leave the Goblin Recruiter hand, but I'm going to play turn two Miria into a turn three Winter Orb and go from there, because that in itself is going to get me a lot more value to be able to Goblin Recruit later, you know, down the line.
So if this is a keepable five, we pitch the Lightning Bolt and the Hyrax Tower Scout then, from what I gather?
There's also some merit to pitching the Goblin Recruiter to it as well and keeping the Lightning Bolt as some extra interaction pieces.
I think there's two interesting hands here. I think there's your two lands and then Recruiter and Birds are pretty stock, right? Those are like the four cards. And I actually think there's an interesting conundrum between if you want to go Orb or Bolt. I think either one of those could potentially be good to keep there. Like if you're in a pod where you could, where you really want to, you want to try for the recruiter line, having Bolt for like opposition agents or like early commanders could be pretty good to have, or other like Rule of Law stacks pieces or something like that. God, what's the, oh my God, I can't think of it now. Archon of Mary.
Yeah, that's right.
That one. I don't like that card. That style of effect, to have that in there, or you can do what Billy said and try and set up the, Emeria Winter Orb and then go for the recruiter line afterwards, which is probably more correct because I think that's what the deck's trying to do. But you know me, I just was trying to go faster, so interesting.
That's a pretty salvageable five, though. I think we ended up getting there.
Yeah, I think that's a good mulligan round today. Yeah, so
let's do one more and call it a day.
That's the theme, right? It's always like, oh, we're done. Never mind.
Yeah, like every time I say we're done, Billy's like, no, I want to do more.
Yeah,
I want to do more.
Game four. What do we got? We have Ancient Tomb, Windswept Teeth, Stomping Ground, a Braid, Deflecting Swat, Kiki Jiki, and a Court of Calling. So, I mean, there's a Kiki combo in here. It's a little bit of a clunky one. I think overall it's probably a ship because we're not getting a lot going fast enough.
If I was playing 2012 casual EDH, I would like love this hand.
Yeah, 2012 hand, snap key.
This is fantastic, right? Like, game's going to go to like turn 17. I'm going to win with this. I am not keeping this in 2022.
Having a deflecting swat in 2012, what do they do? What do they do about it? They don't even know it's coming.
There's also like no artifacts for your commander, which like you can get your commander out on two or on turn three. You can't even get your commander out on two. Oh, God. Yeah, no, that's bad. Get rid of it.
Yeah, it should keep getting worse.
Yeah, the longer you look at it, right? It's like what's that one famous painting? It's like, It goes around like all the social media all the time where it's like, it's a normal painting of like a diner. And the longer you look at it, like there's more like hidden things that are like disturbingly, like eldritchly wrong with the image.
No idea. You're the art guy.
I figured someone saw it. All right, fine. Okay. Next seven, we have Misty Rainforest, Urza Saga, Mana Confluence, Mox Diamond, which is nice because we have three lands, which is a good combination with Mox Diamond. Red Elemental Blast, Goblin Matron, and Collector Oof. So, I mean, I like this hand a lot more. I don't know if you really do like a turn one oof, but like turn two commander into turn three oof is on the table here.
So what's really neat here is you actually... let me get this. I am going to keep this.
Cool. Now that you're keeping it, I have a question. Are you turn one Misty or turn one Urza Saga?
Turn one Misty, pitching the Urza Saga.
You're pitching the Saga to the Mox?
Pitching the Saga to the Mox. Okay.
Oh, what?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of pumpkin spice cold brew nonsense are you on right now?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's what I was waiting for.
Why?
Because with Goblin Matron, I could get to the combo a lot faster.
But Saga?
Yeah.
It's so good.
It is good. But in this case, I'd rather have the three red sources.
Okay, I mean, that's fair. Are you playing... You're not playing the oof then, because you definitely want the Mox for turn.
No. The oof is going to be sitting there and go, I'm going to wait for a second.
Pitching the Saga. Oof. Yeah, I was like, right. I kind of want to just go Saga, Diamond, pitch Confluence, pass, hold up Red Blast. But, man, all right. I'm in for it.
What would you... So what would you... You said pitch the Confluence?
Yeah.
What would you get off the Saga?
I don't know. Soul Ring, Mox Amber, Mox Ruby. I was going to say Mox Ruby, but yeah, basically.
Basically. I mean, Amber is the best hit to get off of that. It does the exact same thing as what I was saying, being able to get you the third red source.
Yeah, or get you whatever you want. Any other piece if your plan changes. It's actually it's an interesting discussion point. I was joking before, but actually it is an interesting discussion point where like your line could actually like lock you down more. You'd be more restrictive and might not. I don't think it's even like faster than my line, right? Because like you're going turn one, like, well, I guess you're, because you need five mana, right? So like you're going two, three, four, five. See, like you're still kind of like off a little bit there. So like, I don't know, it's close. You might be a little more restrictive though. There's a chance.
There is another interesting line here where you don't even cast your commander necessarily. If the Urza Saga gets you to anything that cantrips, such as like a Sensei's Divining Top is an easy example, it does let you use your Goblin Recruiter. It lets you rip the Dockside off the top and get to your actual combo line, or it lets you draw your Snoop that you stacked on top, depending on where you are in the turn cycle. That's like if you do like turn one Urza Saga, then you're fetching for top and cracking your recruiter pile using what you fetched with Urza Saga.
Yeah, there's a lot more versatility. That's why I was just like, oof, when you said you were pitching the saga. So that was just interesting. Good conversation. I still think you're pumpkin spice crazy.
I mean, I am pumpkin spice crazy, but that's besides the point.
There's like four different ways to play this hand, and I mean, we can only say so much in a vacuum, but I think either way you slice it, it's a keep. So
I don't want to say it's the last hand because Billy's going to start screaming one more time.
Don't do it. We've been on this mic for hour and a half.
Now, folks, I'm out of something.
So with that, I think that's a wrap for today. I just want to thank everybody for watching. Again, all the links to everything we've talked about will be in the show notes below. So we'll have Billy's version of the deck list, as well as the Urzit home deck that Y mentioned that's been circulating around. We also have Y's kind of hybrid list version as well that we have in there. We don't think we talked about it much, but it's there as well to look at.
We don't need to. It's okay.
We also have links to our Moxfield profile, as well as all of our socials, Twitter, Instagram, and our own personal Twitter. So be sure to check us out there. Always happy to hear you and see what's going on. So with that, for another week of Commander and Coffee, I am Chris, a.k.a. Cypher.
I continue to be Y.
And last time I checked, I'm Billy, also known as Pork, and I'm all out of coffee.
Also known as the Pumpkin Spice Guy.
I'm just going to change my name to Pumpkin Spice Boy.
He's out of coffee, but for how long? I give him 12 hours before he has a foot in the door of that Starbucks.
I give him till we hang up this recording, but that's just me.
Gotta go, guys. Gotta blast.
All right, guys. Peace out.